we don't think about culture at large as the greatest mission field, where, you know, our theological principles can be translated and embodied in, and it's the arts that can, you know, that's one of the great ways that gifts that God has given us.
This week, we highlight a past episode of our Faith and Imagination podcast. Makoto Fujimura is an acclaimed contemporary artist whose work has been exhibited across the world. He is founder of the International Arts Movement and a former presidential appointee to the National Council on the Arts. Most recently, he is the author of Art and Faith, published in January of last year by Yale University Press.
Spiritual formation is about for being fully human. So that's why I can talk to a modern dancer who, you know, that may not be a believer and say, what you do is holy.
On this episode, Matthew Wickman, founding director of the BYU Humanities Center, speaks with him about those subjects, art and faith, and about finding beauty in human brokenness, the relationship between creativity and religion, and what Fujimura calls the theology of making.
Makoto Fujimura, Mako, it is such a delight to have you on the podcast. Thank you for taking the time.
Oh, it's great to be here. Thank you for having me.
It's an honor. I'm honored that you're doing this for us. And I, you know, our listeners can't see this, but I have Mako is on Zoom, and in the background, some of his paintings are there in the studio, and they're just drop dead gorgeous. I love them. Mako, I usually begin by asking our guests how they imagine faith. In your case, you've written about this very thing in your new book, Faith and Art, and you remark there, I'm quoting here, that it's impossible to have faith without imagination. Mm-hmm. Can you explain what that means?
Yeah, that's a little bit, you know, when you hear that, you say, well, is that true? And of course, we suspect imagination in our culture, as we say, you're imagining things, you know,
this right.
Kind of fantasy, you know, but really, imagination is formed, even as we are coming to know the world through our senses. You know, we have to connect between what we are touching and what we're feeling, and then that gets turned into language and analytic thought, and so imagination is this integrated seat of knowledge that begins as you know, even before we are born, probably, but it is certainly defines human civilization, you know, what we understand to be, you know, the connection between knowledge and the world and what we create into them. So now faith is substance of things unseen, the evidence of the things hoped for. And even in that statement in Hebrews 11, you have a picture of, you know, what is that substance of things unseen, or, you know, things hoped for. Every time an artist faces his or her canvas, every time an architect looks at a ground to which he or she is building on, that requires faith to build something, faith in the future that somebody will be looking at your work. And so without faith, it is impossible to build anything. And I ask in this book, Art Plus Faith, a Theology of Making, that really the critical question we should be asking ourselves in terms of our faith is, what are we making? And so therefore imagination is critical for that journey, and ultimately faith as well, I think.
Absolutely. I love that you invoke here that famous excerpt from Hebrews chapter 11, you know, on faith. I was trained in my PhD program as an 18th centuryist and ended up writing a dissertation about laws of evidence. I was interested in how we experience things that both can be rationally proven and things that we experience that can't be rationally proven but are real things. And I remember getting into the issue of evidence. And one legal, you know, sort of writer from the late 17th century defined evidence etymologically as to see clearly the truth. And I've never been able to sort of read Paul's writing the same way since then, the writing in Hebrews 11 in the King James translation, because the evidence of things unseen is to see clearly the thing which you can't see. It evokes imagination beautifully. So I love that connection you make.
That is a beautiful way of understanding evidence. It is a kind of illumination, isn't it? And how, if we can see things clearly, then by that eyes of the heart, you know, we can see God more clearly. That's very beautiful.
You write, you mentioned this theology of making in this great, but we'll talk about your book more in detail here in a moment. But this theology of making, you write in the book, I'm quoting you here from it, "I now consider what I do in the studio to be theological work as much as aesthetic work." Which I think that's such a provocative phrase. The entire book is full of just really beautiful and provocative formulations that allow us to rethink terms like faith and imagination, you know, and art and number of things. How is it that, in your experience, the work you do in the studio is theological as much as aesthetic?
Yeah, and I wrote that, and a friend of mine read my book and said, you know, that is true about every human endeavor, you know, that is. So he is a kind of a guru on work and faith. He helps a lot of business folks connect their faith to their work. And he said, you know, this is a book that's enormously helpful for them, because if you just replace art with or work with making, it makes more sense, you know.
Right, yeah.
So the work is theological. And I wrote that from this visceral sense of the Holy Spirit moving in me and through my work that I have this privilege of experiencing every day in the studio. There's a direct connection between my experience of God and my act of painting. But that is, in essence, what all work can be if we have that, first of all, intimate connection with the Creator, but also our understanding of the sanctification reality of how the Holy Spirit can intervene in every endeavor in any moment.
Nice. I love the idea about the inspiration, right, that you get to experience daily in the studio. You write early in your book about being introduced to Christianity a little later in your life, and you liken it to like a trickle of water furrowing its way through your interests in literature and art, and eventually it led you to connect what you were experiencing to the message of Christianity.
Yes.
My question is this: once you had converted to Christianity, did your art continue to develop organically, or did the experience of conversion change your art in some meaningful or substantive way?
Yeah, it certainly had impact, but it is like trickle water. I call my conversion experience inversion because I always, you know, felt that I knew God in some way through art and through what I was observing. And I thought everybody had these experiences, you know, and because anytime I painted, I felt this charge go through me, and I knew that was a gift and it wasn't mine. And I felt this as a child, and I remember thinking about it, and I just assumed everybody had this experience, you know, and then I went to middle school, you know, and found out. But that's quite unusual. You shouldn't talk about it to your friends, you know. But yeah. But you know, I so when I heard the voice of Christ through literature, through reading the Bible, really opening my heart to the stories and the word of Christ in particular, I identify that voice as the source of this experience I was already having. And that's why it was so inevitable that I will be a follower of Christ. And I didn't even know that I had become a Christian until years later when, you know, my Christian friends, missionary friends were like asking me, because I kept on saying I was not a Christian. You know, mm-hmm. I have all sorts of problems with the church and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, they were like, but you believe Christ was the Son of God? And I say, of course, yeah. This undeniable voice resonates in me. And you think he resurrected? And I said, absolutely, of course. How could he not? You know, and just went down the checklist, and they said, you know, you are a Christian, you know. And I said, no, I'm not. You know, I cannot be a Christian. So at that point, you know, it was like recognizing that God had been opening my eyes since I was a child, and it took until I was 27 to recognize that voice and identify that voice. But I knew immediately that this was absolutely the central reality of creation. I didn't understand Christ as a creator until much later, you know, when I was studying Colossians. But I knew immediately that this salvific knowledge, what Christians call, you know, particular grace, is very much connected to the voice of creation, and this is through Christ. Christ's voice echoes that voice of, you know, Genesis, and it was undeniable to me from the beginning.
You're describing here, I to me, as I hear it, I think that's remarkable spiritual perceptivity on your part. It really is. And to be able to sort of come to understand over time, you know, what it was that was inspiring your art. I find that really to be, the story itself is an inspiring story. You obviously have a gift as an artist, a spiritual gift, I'd call it, as an artist. It's right, but you also are a really gifted writer. This book, do you prefer art and faith or art plus faith? It's art plus faith.
You know, it began as theology of making, and okay. In Yale, when they, you know, as all publishers do, wanted to place this in the right context, and they came up with art and faith. And then the designer decided to put plus. And I like that. I like that, you know, kind of a calculus, you know, R plus faith, you know, and R plus faith equal what, you know, you know, I had fun with this, promoting it on Twitter, but I think, you know, there's something very beautiful about the design. You know, the cover uses my series, Walking on Water series, which is behind me, which the listeners can't see, so they have to go to my website to see them. But and art plus faith, you know. So I started to say art plus faith.
Okay, I should mention for our listeners, yeah, if you want to go to Mako's website, makotofujimura.com, it's there are a lot of pieces there of his art. It's beautiful. It's a beautiful website, and there's a couple short little documentaries about his work on there. And I highly recommend it. What was the inception of the book? Why did you decide? Because you have this, you express your faith in your art. What then moved you to want to write this book as well?
Right. So the book is my life work, and it's one third of what I originally wrote. And my editor and I went through and made sure that it had this cohesiveness as a entry point, you know. And we decided to talk about John 11:35, two words, Jesus wept, as a central focus and a kind of a pinhole through which the entire book will be organized around. And it's my life work, because as soon as I read the Bible, I had the sense that this voice of creation and the Bible itself is about creativity and imagination. And then you rarely hear sermons about that, but I will go back, and even the passages that will be spoken about, every time I had the sense that God was opening these revelation that clearly was not only connected back to Genesis, but connected to new creation. Those were my personal thoughts. I would write them down in my, you know, diary and just ponder them. If I went to my church and initially I was going to this missionary church, so there were a lot of missionaries in Japan, and I get very excited about Exodus 31, Bezalel and Oholiab creating the mercy seat, 1.5 cubits by 2.5 cubits with acacia wood and gold, and how that symbolized, this mercy of God, because I think, because that's why it's 1.5 and 2.5. Half is a symbolism that we need God's help. And they'll just look at me like, absolutely, like, not only did they not, think about that as a central premise, but they skipped that part because it was, there's all these, numbers, and it didn't make sense to them. And, I'm like, how could you, like this is for an artist, like, I can see it. I can see Bezalel and Oholiab creating this. I can see why this would be in the Holy of Holies, why the Decalogue would be housed within it, and why they needed this communication box, and that, for worship, nomadic worship to begin. And so I kept those thoughts to myself, and, for many years, because, people thought I was, that's an artist reading the Bible. And then, I guess about 8 years ago, I was writing another book, which became Refractions and Culture Care, about essays and about culture in general. I was on the National Council on the Arts, appointed by President Bush, trying to advocate for U.S. arts. And so I would speak at a museum or, UNESCO meeting or whatever. And I wanted to write down these thoughts to defend or advocate for the arts. But, I've always thought theologically about issues, even arts issues. So I had the theological principles, behind everything I did. When I talk about culture care, I always think about Galatians 5, fruit of the Spirit is love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, and so forth. And what kind of culture would that birth? And isn't that what we are after when we are watching modern dancer struggle to make that leap, or defending the value of poetry in our very utilitarian pragmatic world, and I in my mind I had all these theological threads that obviously you don't talk about in the museum. So I on the way back I would be writing these things down in my notebook on the airplane. And then one time I remember this specifically, something occurred to me, like, it's not because I'm an artist that I read the Bible this way. It's because God is the artist. So I, as an artist, understand and can open up this text in a way that perhaps is a unique perspective, but everybody, in order to understand the gospel. So what that does for me is, if I can articulate this better, which I try to do in my previous books, Culture Care, and other books, then, you know, the theological precepts will be translated into culture. So, you know, we are, by being missional, we are, you know, trying to fulfill a great commission, but we don't think about culture at large as the greatest mission field, where, you know, our theological principles can be translated and embodied in, and it's the arts that can, you know, that's one of the great ways that gifts that God has given us. So when I, you know, started to work backwards, that became this book, Theology of Making, all these principles that I don't reveal when I'm talking, you know, defending modern dancers.
Okay. No, that's a fascinating story about the inception of the book, and a lot of rich reflection you just gave us right there. If I could ask you about a couple parts of the book, I love the entire thing. Let me ask one part of it. You mentioned Kintsugi, right? The, yes. And I hope I said that correctly, but
yes,
okay, did. All right. The art of binding together broken pieces of pottery using a lacquer gilded with gold. And you remark that this is what you imagine resurrection will look like, right? That the broken pieces serving as a token of the new world to come. I wonder if you could speak a bit more to that connection that you make there.
Of course. Kintsugi flows out of the tea tradition of Japan, notably tea masters like Senno Rikyu or Furuta Oribe, 17th century, 16th and 17th century. They refined so much of what became what we know as wabi-sabi aesthetic of Japan, refined it into very much an enduring value and aesthetic, and Kintsugi comes out of that. So in Western mind, if something is broken, you throw it away or fix it as if nothing ever happened. And that's the ideal of perfection. And in Japan, you know, something that is imperfect is valued more than something that has been perfected. You know, this concept of Kintsugi is rather than mending the broken teaware with you know, super glue and pretending like it didn't break, you highlight the fractures and you mend it with Japan lacquer so it can be reused by a tea master, and then gold flake or gold paint is placed on the cracks as if they, you know, they are rivers of gold, and that highlights and creates a new landscape with the cracks. And so Kintsugi master, Japan lacquer masters, and this has been notoriously difficult to practice, kind of a secret tradition, until recently when one Kintsugi master that I've gotten to know after the 2011 tsunami disaster, earthquake and tsunami in Tohoku, Japan, decided that he saw so many orphans up north in Japan. You know, they were left, their entire village, fishing villages were washed away, grandparents and parents were washed away. Only thing that was left in the home was broken ceramics. And so he wanted to go up as a work of compassion to mend these broken bowls for them. But then he thought, well, if I did Kintsugi for them as a Kintsugi master, that would be one gesture, but it would be better if they learned to do it, right?
Yes.
So he worked with a fishing rod company who was creating a kind of new Japan lacquer called urushi, new urushi, that was made from cashew nuts, so it was easier to handle. Traditional Japan lacquer is made from poison sumac, so you know, you shouldn't have children working with these.
Right.
So it was a work of compassion that created this kit. He literally packed these little tubes in a medicine bag and traveled all over Northern Japan to, and he was just back there for the 10th commemoration doing kintsugi with children. But you know, this really moved me, and I really wanted to learn kintsugi myself with him. And so we've been collaborating and launched a thing called Kintsugi Academy, creating, you know, small groups that, of course, you know, before the pandemic, and now we have to do things remotely, but we're training our leaders so we can have more people participate in this.
I think it's fantastic. I love both the story you tell about, you know, kind of the origin of the academy and coming out of the terrible, you know, earthquake and tidal wave in Japan, but also how you describe, you know, kind of the beauty of the brokenness of these pieces and emphasizing these rivers of gold. You put it kind of through.
So theologically, you know, post-resurrection appearance of Jesus is specific to his wounds. Still, his marks are still with him, and Thomas, you know, says, I won't believe until I can touch the wounds. And Jesus shows up and says, here I am, you know, go ahead and touch. And he doesn't touch the wounds, and he kneels down and worships. He's the first male disciple to do so. And I think that's very significant, both in terms of Christ's wounds are still there, and it is through his wounds that we are healed. And, you know, the post-resurrection encounter, it would indicate that, you know, whatever has created the stigmata of our lives, or, you know, what fractures that led to holiness or sanctification will remain in some way. And there are no more tears, so these marks are never meant to be, you know, to look back and lament, but they're meant to be literally part of the new creation somehow. And I don't fully understand it, but, you know, it makes sense to me that because Jesus chose to remain human after the resurrection, right, he didn't just grow wings and disappear, you know, although right, the ascension is, you know, going into another dimension, but he remains human there. He chooses to be one of us, and therefore giving us hope that, you know, being human, being fully human is the goal of, you know, being our journey of toward sanctification, and the spiritual formation is about for being fully human. So that's why I can talk to a modern dancer who, you know, that may not be a believer and say, what you do is holy, right? What you're cultivating is a language of impossibility that I can see as a follower of Christ that leads into the new creation. And therefore what you do to me is invaluable. And that, you know, theological kind of conversation can bring us to appreciating all that there is around us that is so confusing at times, because you're not quite sure if the spirit is behind it or not, but it almost affirms, right? Christ's post-resurrection wounds affirm that whatever it is, even the worst case scenario is going to be turned into something that is literally new creation that we can worship.
As you talk, Mako, I'm really struck by how much and really how beautifully art and faith and theology and making really do inform each other in your life and work. You know, as a related point to that, I love the question you pose in the chapter that you write on Kintsugi. You say this, what kind of a church would we become if we simply allowed broken people to gather and did not try to fix them, but simply to love and behold them, contemplating the shapes that broken pieces can inspire? you put it that way, and it's just, it's so beautiful and it's so obvious. But we have, I think, a difficult time as people mustering that kind of forgiving perception of our own brokenness and brokenness in others. Why is that, you know, or in your experience, or if not, why is that, then is there a way to bring that out, that vision out in each other? Would we become more forgiving of that in each other?
Boy, you know, this was my encounter with Nakamura-san, the master, Kintsugi master. And, you know, he, who is not a Christian, but is very open to the spirit, was telling me that, you know, I write this in the book, but the one of the greatest, highest honor as a Kintsugi master is not to even mend, not to fix the broken bowls, but simply behold the fragments and to imagine the whole, right, that once was, and imagine new creation. And he doesn't use those words, but to me, that's what he was saying. And so you behold the fragments. And I was there with a friend of mine who is a pastor, and we just turned to each other and we said, you know, he's an African-American leader and connected to my fellows program. And we were just, you know, pondering that and saying, what kind of church would that be? You know, if we could just learn to behold the fragments and see beauty and see new creation, see all that potential that all of us have. And, you know, we came away thinking that, you know, that would certainly be very unusual and maybe even transgressive to the church programs and, you know, bigger the better kind of a thing, you know, the spectacles that we create in order to be successful. It's almost the reverse of unlearning all that we learn in church planting and, you know, what we learn in schools about, you know, resume building and, you know, all of that. And saying, you know, maybe the imperfections can liberate us from ourselves and our propensity to create institutions rather than movements. And we can simply be a group of people who welcome the broken and these fragments. And rather than saying, you know, we have programs to fix you, you know, no, we're going to rejoice in the particularities of your brokenness and your uniqueness and in your journey, because, you know, it's like a puzzle piece, right, that fits into the hole in God's eyes. But we can't see that. So all we can do, you know, right now and here in our community is to welcome you and to behold that and as you can do mine. And that kind of community exists. I've been part of it. I've seen, but there are, you know, very few compared to what the church ought to be. And certainly when we think about, you know, what the non-Christians say about our churches, right, which is very convicting, it is the opposite of the fruit of the Spirit. You know, instead of love, we seem to hate people, you know, in public spheres. Instead of having joy, we seem to be rather grim and, you know, depressed. And instead of having peace, we seem to be rather anxious and so forth. So, you know, I just had to think, what kind of a church can we be if we became a Kintsugi church?
It's a great question. In my own, religious practice, I feel like when I'm at my most authentic before God, it's in acknowledging my own brokenness. I feel like there are moments in my community, my religious community, that really embrace that kind of idea. And then, of course, we get back into our habits, you know. So in a way, what's interesting is it's the unrealized possibility of seeing each other that way, which suggests that our communities are in their own way kind of broken. And the sad part is they don't recognize their own brokenness, right?
Right. And we seek some kind of a perfection in the Western conception of perfection. You know, we want this ideal, and we, you know, shop around, try to find a perfect church, and, you know, and all that is understandable. That's, you know, that's the consumer mindset, you know, that is part of what we have built as a cultural language. But the church ought to be different. Church ought to be a place of authenticity and hope, you know, despite what you see or despite what you are experiencing yourself. And, you know, I think in the fractures of our time, instead of, you know, so I do advocate, instead of fighting culture wars, you know, let's see culture as a garden to steward rather than battle zone to fight over. And, you know, artists tends to be the worker bees that go in the front lines of pollination of culture. And, you know, these artists are very, very vulnerable to pesticides and, you know, aggressive bulldozing of your land. So you know, that's, you know, I'm not fighting a war against culture wars, but I do think that there's a better way of tending to the ecosystem of culture.
Let me go back to something you said earlier, that this motif, this, you called it a pinhole for the book, this yes. Tears of Christ. Can you speak to how that brings together some of these different motifs in the book?
Right. So even to the question that you know, you asked me previously, you know, about the unnecessary ways, right, that you know, beholding the fragments, that if you don't fix anything, then that's like, you know, useless in a sense, right? That you're not doing anything, you know. But, you know, Jesus stood on the hills of Bethany weeping with Mary when all he had to do was, you know, take her hand and bring her to the grave and say, Lazarus, come out. And he could have turned to her and said, you know, you have little faith, you know, why are you weeping? You should, you know, you know, just have faith in me. He doesn't do that. He acknowledges her pain and her anger and her ways of, you know, grieving for the loss of her brother. And she was probably upset that Jesus didn't show up in the most dire need that they had, you know, knowing that her brother was dying. You know, this miracle worker should come and heal. Of course he would come because he loves them, and he didn't. So again, why didn't he just triumphantly get to the point, you know? Rather, he wasted time with Mary weeping. The word of God stood silent on the hills of Bethany and wept. And to me, that is the pinhole through which we can access the entire gospel and gospel narratives and the entire Bible. You know, so I note in the book that creation itself is gratuitous. God's aseity, the concept of self-sufficiency and all sufficiency of God, tells us that we are not needed for God's project. The entire universe is not needed. But God created because God is love. And God creates out of abundance and gratuity and extravagance. And so it flows right into Jesus' tears and Mary's reaction to those tears. And to me, that is at the heart of theology of making.
It's a great insight. It reminds me of another moment later in the Gospel of John, chapter 20, when Mary Magdalene's weeping outside the grave. You know, and there's that moment there where she turns and sees Jesus, doesn't recognize him. And he asks her the question, you know, basically, why are you weeping and who are you seeking? And what I love about that is that he might have said, hey, it's me. But instead, by asking the question, letting her articulate why she's sad, it's Christ dignifying human pain.
Yeah, and he says, do not touch me.
Yes.
Which is also interesting. And I do think, and you know, he rose as a gardener, not as an industrial lord, I say in the book, but you know, right. That's significant too, right?
Absolutely.
He's a steward. He's the, a shepherd in Greek is poiemen. You know, he's the one that stewards with poetry and art and beauty, and that scene, that tender scene, is so much about again the post-resurrection reality of new creation that is to come. That's why Mary cannot touch him yet, because this is reserved for all of us to one day be face to face physically with the resurrection reality, and that is going to be not only a moment of celebration but a moment of recognition where our eyes and our hearts are fully open to who he is.
I could talk to you all day, Marco. I really could. But time is getting on. Let me conclude with something. Okay. It's a beautiful thought you share in your book about surrendering ourselves to God, and you write this. You say, in my experience, when we surrender all to the greatest artist, it's capital A artist, God, right? That artist fills us with the spirit and makes us even more creative and aware of the greater reality all about us. By giving up our art, we are paradoxically made into true artists of the kingdom. Now, you echo here the words of Jesus, those who lose their lives for my sake shall save them or find them. Have you seen this principle borne out in your own life? And I'm curious if it means different things to you with the passage of time.
Right. As an artist, you know, you're trained to self-express, and you are asked in many cases to develop your ego, you know, strong self to be able to express yourself. And I find that's counterproductive over time. And this I realized even before I heard the voice of Christ, but it made sense when I did. And because Jesus himself gave his life for us, and the sacrificial expression is the ultimate way that we can create anything new. But even before that, you know, I recognized that, you know, first of all, this cult of self-expression or ego, you know, of an artist is an illusion in a sense, because you unless you have community around you to, you know, really as iron sharpens iron, you really press against each other's gifts, you don't cultivate the gift that you have. And in order to do that, you have to give yourself away in some way, in however small ways, and history of art proves this. So you know, while like the whole educational premise to me is suspect, then, you know, I think it is true that, you know, once I realized that God is the only artist, true artist for me, that can create something ex nihilo, something that is out of, you know, even before creation was even a concept, God created. You know, that kind of blows my mind. But that kind of love exists, and love is sacrificial. So you're always pushing yourself to give yourself away in a sense. And artists are doing this, even if they struggle with their egos and narcissistic tendencies, you know, they are able to release something into the world the world that rejects them, the world that, you know, doesn't understand them at the time, but they are able to give something back in the most pregnant way. And I was standing on the hills of Jerusalem, looking down, and you can see from you know, where now there's David's King David's Tower. Who knows where that was, but you know, you can see down, and you can see the Garden of Gethsemane, the Valley of Shadow of Death, and then the cemeteries, and beyond, where Bethany would be. To the left would be a road that leads to Emmaus, and I climbed those, you know, hills, and I try to imagine the post-resurrection appearance of Jesus in Emmaus and beyond. And then I realize, you know, how the pilgrimage of the Jewish pilgrimage would be chanting the songs of ascent, you know, to Jerusalem. Now it is reversed. This will be a song of descent for us, that will go out, as Peter had to do, back to Galilee, and then, you know, to the ocean and beyond, you know, and then Paul beyond the horizons into the world, and the Great Commission will carry us in this descent, rather than ascending to Jerusalem, we are descending into the darkest place of the world, so that the light, the Jesus light, can be, you know, can be brought there. And so that, you know, reversal of is very much what I experienced as an artist. You know, I was trying to get to Jerusalem, you know, and doing my best to reach this transcendence and power and beauty of whatever art can bring. And yet I at one point I realized it's the reverse. It's songs of descent. It's just, you know, it's mercy that carries us into true beauty, that allows us to journey with the Spirit into bringing beauty into the darkest places of the world.
Mako Fujimura, thank you for the beauty of your work and your words. It's a joy talking with you.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Faith and Imagination Podcast. This podcast is sponsored by the BYU Humanities Center and the College of Humanities at Brigham Young University, and is produced and edited by Abby Thatcher and Bobby May. The music for this podcast is composed by Ethan Wickman and is performed by Nicholas Phillips on Albany Records. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave us a review on your podcast platform. And if you're interested in other episodes or would like to know more about the BYU Humanities Center, check out our website at humanitiescenter.byu.edu. Thanks again for listening.